This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Kind of a crazy busy week. We haven't had a chance to record on our normal schedule. We had some older stuff that like needed post-production, and this is the lead up to that. I did want to put some true crime news in here. The first thing I wanted to bring up in this episode was, did you see that there was a Riley Connor decision made?
Which one is that?
So Riley Connor, this was the Felicia,
North Carolina.
Yeah. This is the North Carolina case. It was the Felicia Porter case from 2016.
Right.
Riley Connor, he was, according to the Columbus County News. Now, this is one of those cases, like I'm pulling from a news article right now, but it's one of those that if you go read the paperwork on it, there's so much paperwork in the appeal document. It is fascinating. So when he was 15 years old, Riley Connor went to his aunt's house. His aunt was Felicia Porter, and he lured her out of her home in Tabor City, North Carolina. It's kind of a rural area. And her body ends up being found the next day because her husband, you know, reports her missing, and ground searchers start looking around her house and the wooded areas around her house. So initially, an older cousin gets blamed for the crime, but DNA evidence ends up showing that it is, in fact, this 15-year-old boy. The way it went down was the family thought she had gone to the supermarket nearby, but instead, he had lured her outside and he had hit her in the face with a shovel and then raped her. Now, this is his aunt. And then he had continued to beat her with a shovel and dragged her body into the woods. And there, it's all sorts of like messed up. But the bottom line is he was indicted by a grand jury on charges of first degree murder, first degree forcible rape, larceny of a motor vehicle, possession of stolen property, breaking and entering, multiple other larcenies related to this break-in at a store nearby where he stole like a huge amount of cigarettes. There was a landmark case, an Alabama case called Miller versus Alabama, where there was a juvenile defendant in that case who had been sentenced to life without parole. Under North Carolina law, juvenile murder defendants typically are eligible for parole after 25 years in prison. The issue was Riley Connor ends up being found guilty of all of this. And there are like a huge amount of what I call mitigating factor arguments, but there's also aggravating factor arguments, which like included his previous record. The way he gets sentenced, which was he pleads out to first degree murder and first degree rape in February of 2019. And there's this massive plea deal where he's convicted of those charges, but they're kind of consolidating them all. He ends up sentenced to 45 years in prison before he could be considered for parole. So essentially, he's a life with the possibility of parole because of how it shakes out with his age. By the time he's sentenced, he is, if I've got this correct, 17 years old. And he wouldn't be eligible for parole until he's in his 60s. So they've decided that this case needs to go back for resentencing, that it's unconstitutional because it basically is a life sentence for him. And that's based on the Miller versus Alabama ruling, where it doesn't mean they're automatically not going to get a life sentence. It just means that they're required to have a specific type of hearing rather than just de facto being sentenced to these long, sprawling prison sentences. This is a particularly brutal crime. So I was a little surprised that this is the route it went, but not so surprised that like it needed a rehearing.
Well, it's interesting. And you know, this is being semantic. This is playing semantics. But so you said that he was found guilty, and I distinguish pleading guilty from being found guilty. I know a lot of people probably don't, and it probably doesn't really matter. And I'm not saying he's not guilty, but he pleaded guilty to, like you said, the murder and rape charges, and he gets sentenced to 25 years and 20 years to be run consecutively. So that's where they're piled on one another, as opposed to being served at the same time, right?
Yeah, it's a boxcar sentence.
And so now his defense attorney, it's weird because so he pleads out to this, understanding what the sentence is going to most likely be. But his attorney filed a motion with the court, I guess maybe because they ended up making it concurrently as opposed to consecutively as opposed to concurrently. His attorney filed a motion with the court that life with parole, which is what it would essentially be based on how old he would be when he got out. And then it was the court denied the motion that he not have those sentences run like that. And I wonder if that was the grounds for it being relooked at, because when you take a plea agreement, it seems odd to me that that little detail wouldn't have been ironed out first.
The way it ends up before the appellate court is even more complicated than that, because what they started with, if you go through and like read the history of this case, is the judge just sort of stacks all these additional requirements, including a satellite-based monitoring requirement, a lifetime satellite-based monitoring requirement. So the way that it ends up, like sort of going through the appellate process. So in North Carolina, what they do is you start out in a district court when you're charged. You move to superior court for like arraignment, for indictment. So basically the district court is really just an appearance saying you've been charged. And then when you get to superior court, that's where all the actions take place. There is a court of appeals, which is the first step. And then there's the Supreme Court of North Carolina. And beyond that, it would have to go to federal court for other types of hearings if it were eligible for those. But this is so the way that it gets into the appellate courts is like a lot of quabbling over how the sentences are stacked and all of the requirements related to it. The defendant's arguments were that the consecutive sentences were not permitted under the North Carolina statute, which is like they call them the Miller Fix statutes. It's a very specific thing that the legislature had to deal with related to this Miller versus Alabama decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. But he also argued that the sentences were the functional equivalent of life without parole, like you said, and thus they would be unconstitutional imposed on what is considered to be a redeemable juvenile. And then the lifetime satellite-based monitoring without a hearing was the third argument that the defense was making on appeal.
And so the only thing that I can really kind of, so, you know, I don't know how long it's been, but not so long ago, a lot of practices in criminal court that violate like what is reasonable and prudent of the Eighth Amendment, which is, you know, all citizens of the United States have the right to not be cruelly and unusually punished. And yes, as that concept has made its way through the different courts, they've decided that I think recently, I don't know that it's aired or, but we talked about how someone who had a cognitive disability couldn't be sentenced to death. And because under the Constitution, that's considered cruel and unusual punishment. And through different cases, the court system has worked out like, you know, what is a cognitive deficiency? And so in this case, we've got a kid here who committed a heinous crime. And this case is pretty recent. I think you said 2016 is when the crime occurred.
Correct.
And so going along with that Eighth Amendment, trying to sort of iron out, because basically it says just like, you know, putting somebody to death that's cognitively deficient, sentencing a child, a minor to life in prison is cruel and unusual. My issue is that this was a plea deal, right?
I know. That's where I was kind of headed with this.
So when you make a plea deal, the plea deal is essentially a negotiation between a defense attorney and state's prosecutor. And so you're pleading guilty under terms that are worked out like way beforehand before you go before the judge. Typically, the judge, you know, it's a rubber stamp situation, because if judges had to like analyze every single case that came before them with a plea deal, I mean, that's the way it really should be, but like we just don't have the resources in place to do that. And so the majority of the time, you know, the judge trusts the defense attorney and the prosecutor to have come to a fair arrangement. And that way the case is disposed of. So you've entered a guilty plea and then you go before the judge. And I've seen it happen both ways. I've seen it happen where the judge says, I'm not prepared to sentence you according to your plea agreement. Are you sure you want to plead guilty? Right? And then I've also seen it not be offered for the plea to change and the judge just to make the sentence regardless of the plea agreement. That like really undermines our that part of our judicial system, right? Because if you plead guilty to something thinking that you've got this deal and then you're sentenced to the maximum all of a sudden under your guilty plea, that's going to create a lot of problems. And so in this case, I can't figure out why the plea was made and then immediately... Did you happen to see, was it because of the way it was imposed?
Yeah. So the imposition of the sentence plus the additional elements is what really are the impetus for the, like the appeals process, but then they ramp it up because of the Miller versus Alabama decision. So that decision ends up, the idea is that this case was not in line with how North Carolina looked at Miller versus Alabama. And this case was unfolding sort of as Miller versus Alabama was being like, so that case, it's actually a very old case, but the way that it was like argued and decided was in like 2012. And like Miller ends up with his resentencing hearing. I think it was in 2017 or 2018. And the point being, the defense was able to use that as one of the three arguments that they were making. But the other part of it was that they were surprised by both the lifetime satellite-based monitoring, which means this kid will forever have an ankle device.
I don't necessarily think that that's I don't feel like that's too much, but that's a different story.
Well, but the defense attorney wasn't saying it was too much or wasn't too much. He was saying the kid didn't get a hearing on that. So that's the other problem I have with this, is it's very difficult to say, oh, they didn't get a hearing on this when a plea deal has been worked out. But in this case, like you said, North Carolina was abiding by this open plea policy, which is so everyone knows what that is. It's very similar to how you described it. When you go forward, the defense and the prosecution have worked something out, but they're putting an open plea on the table where the defense is going to ask the judge for something and the prosecution is going to recommend to the judge something. And those two things are generally in line with each other. Sometimes there's some variables on the prosecution side. Like the defense may say, he's going to plead to manslaughter and we only want to do 8 years and we want him out. And the prosecution may say, well, we'll do an open manslaughter plea. And what we're going to recommend to the judge is that it's 8 to 15. And like, you know, it'll be somewhere in there for your guy. So that's how people generally get what they want. The problem is that judges sometimes have a stick up their ass and they want to make a point. And sometimes they're doing it for good reasons. And sometimes they're doing it because of the ego that comes with being a judge in North Carolina. That ego can sometimes end up with a boxcar sentence like this, where it's kind of ridiculous. Although I will say, this is an incredibly heinous crime. Like, he did this to his aunt. And it's a terrible crime. We haven't even got to what like blew my mind about this case yet. So if you have anything else you want to say about it, I would do that now, because like I totally don't understand how it's back.
The only thing I would say is I feel like what's going to happen. So this has to, he's not like, his conviction wasn't overturned. His sentence is what has been overturned, unless they just,
the sentence has been thrown out. Yeah. Not
unless they just nullified the plea agreement. So I feel like what's going to happen is they're just going to change it to be concurrent terms.
I think that you're probably right. I wondered if, because it was a plea agreement and the sentence is thrown out, does that put it back on the table for him to withdraw the plea? And I say generally the answer would be no to that. But in this case, because it's like there's so many variables, I was wondering if that might be the case that this ends up actually going to trial. I think it's just going for a resentencing hearing right now, but that is a motion. That's an option.
I don't feel like that they remanded it back for a new trial.
No, they didn't.
It was just a resentencing. And so he doesn't, this court would have had to say that he had the right to a trial.
Right. So this is the thing that blew my mind about this case. Have you read like some of the court documents around it?
I haven't read any of the court documents on this.
Okay. Okay. Cause I kind of threw this at you at the last minute cause it was very shocking to me.
No, I just read, I read where the court had had remanded it back to the lower court. That's all.
So when you get appellate documents, and we've explained this like in different ways, in different times, you get a lot of factual summaries. And that's just sort of what everybody has either decided has been proven in court, or it's what's been presented as evidence and sort of certified.
It's the record of the case.
Yeah, it's the record of the case. This case, which is, I'll just call it Felicia Porter's murder, Riley Connor's conviction, because that's probably the right, I may have said found guilty early. I think that you called me out on that, and that's correct. The better word is the plea agreement and conviction here. And like, there's not really any dispute that he did it. Like all the testing and everything related to this case, although there was an initial suspect, he had a hand in that. Like, he ID'd somebody and said that person did this. It turned out to be him.
Right. And it's not necessarily relevant in this case. I'm just saying that I find a difference between a jury finding someone guilty and someone pleading guilty.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And like, that was just, I am on the same boat as you with that. What messed with me about this case is I got into like the mitigating factors, and I'm not going to like belabor it because like I sort of am torn. Like, is that like excusing the crime or something? But Riley Connor, he was born in 2000. This crime happens in 2016, and this kid truly had no chance, like, at all. And they were having, like, he had siblings, so they had multiple kids. But even the week right after the crime, and this is not me speculating, this is doctor's testimony. If you, like, go through it, you can find it as the North Carolina versus Connor case. If you just look up R-I-L-E-Y, which is Riley Connor, C-O-N-N-E-R, appeal, it'll give you like a lot of the court documents. They're available online, at least to some degree. They're a little more implicit in the record itself. But what's amazing about this is, so first of all, the week after the murders, he was hospitalized with absolutely uncontrollable seizures to the point that he damaged an MRI machine and broke a hospital bed. So while a lot of people use that as like an excuse that like something is wrong in his head or whatever, and you'll see a lot of like forensic psychology, I call it some of it BS, but the gist of this was everyone in Riley Connor's life, if I'm like the immediate tentacles of his family tree, if I'm really like honest about it, they're terrible people. He has a few people that are redeeming him there. And I'm not going to differentiate and name who's who. You can read the story like online. But there was a theft of a large amount of cigarettes being used by a family member's van. Riley Connor does the theft. He steals like cartons and cartons of cigarettes. And the gist is all of this happens because he thinks he's going to get turned in. So he goes to punish this aunt, Felicia Porter. But as far as his parents and all of the people around him, this defendant literally never had a chance. And I want to like just say that that doesn't excuse that he committed this crime. This kid has head injuries in the record and severe scarring and damage to his frontal lobe as early as 4 years old. 4 years old. So I've never seen a case that I looked at it and I went, well, that guy probably like needs like a serious sentencing hearing where they consider like a mixture of like how much time he's going to do and how much time it's going to be in a hospital versus a prison. His mental acuity at trial was testified to be 62. And we've talked about ranges. Most of the episodes haven't aired yet, but you and I have talked about those before. Once you get below 70, you're in an area where the Supreme Court starts to question like what the sentence could be, whether it can be death or life without parole. But this kid was addicted to multiple drugs by the age of 12. And the people around him, like there were a couple of people that were really trying for him the best of their ability. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that their efforts were rewarded. This kid just had no chance. He is so far, like they diagnose him with different conduct disorders. He has multiple problems with alcohol and cannabis. It's a 15-year-old they're examining when they're doing this. He's 15 and 16 years old at the time of the examinations that show up. The worst parts of life sort of culminate in this kid's case. He was being supplied with alcohol, cocaine, opiates, methamphetamines, PCP, heroin. And on the day of the crime, he was heavily intoxicated with marijuana and PCP. That doesn't excuse that the crime happened. This kid just absolutely had no chance. And I run into that like from time to time where I just look at a case and I go, I don't understand. But the night terrors in this kid's case were documented by outside sources when he was 7 years old. So when I think about kids like him, like getting some kind of resentencing hearing, like this is what I want to ask you. Do you think that makes any difference in this case?
His sentence is going, they could resentence him to the exact same thing, taking the, what the upper court has remanded it with, but it will just get appealed again. I feel like, now you did mention that at the time of what would have been the trial, which didn't occur because he had a plea agreement, his IQ was at 62. So that is in the record.
Yeah, it's in here. They introduced all these things in pretrial motions. That's how I have all this information.
So the first situation, being a juvenile is way easier to prove than the IQ or the cognitive deficiency element of the Eighth Amendment, right?
Right.
Because, your age is documented. And they get into some kind of, gray area when it comes to, like, what a cognitive deficiency sufficient to. Of course, that's just with the death penalty cases anyway, I believe. I don't think there's anything that's – there is no so far I don't think that cognitive deficiency is an acceptable reason for somebody to not be sentenced to life in prison. This kid clearly needs help. It's unfortunate that he wasn't – it's unfortunate that he lived a life that he did. And – in our justice system, there's a constant grapple with, these sort of just really sad cases of, kids not having chances. Unfortunately, the justice system doesn't really come into play until somebody's done something, right? Like in this case, he murdered his aunt. Before that, the state was involved through Child Protective Services, right? But it wasn't enough to get him sort of on the right track. And so, the fact that he was a minor, I would say at 15, no matter what level of cognitive deficiency or brain damage that had occurred, if he's not going to be in prison for the rest of his life, he's going to be institutionalized for sure, I think, because he is suffering from major problems and he would need to be under a doctor's care given all the, I guess you would call them mitigating circumstances of why perhaps he committed this crime. He needs help.
Yeah, I don't. So I'm so torn on like how you deal with these cases that are this brutal to family members. And it's interesting, like this case has so much paperwork and so much work that was done on it. So it happens in 2016. Whenever someone has a traumatic death like that, and this is, I don't get into splitting traumas where like I rate them or say this is more traumatic than that traumatic, but this truly is like, so you've got a defendant who, in my opinion, is also a victim of multiple people. And then you've got a victim of that defendant who has suffered like this absolutely horrific ending to their life. And it becomes like very frustrating to look at law enforcement and look at the criminal justice system and to say, you know, well, good job, everybody. It's hard to do that in a case like this because on the one hand, you know, this kid's sort of been failed. And on the other hand, this woman had this horrible ending. And you have an entire family of, you know, varying levels of criminality who are now all victims of like this having happened.
Right. And the court hasn't made any sort of distinction as to the crime itself. All they've said is that subject to Miller, like you're saying, even though it's not said to be a life sentence, a 25 and 20 year sentence run consecutively, which means one after the other, is in effect a life sentence for this kid. And so, right. You know, it's got to be sent back. And like I said, I feel like it'll be just changed to the sentences running concurrently. And that means they would be run at the same time. So then you're going to have 25 years to be eligible for parole. Yeah. And then you need the resources in place, the state does, to make an accurate determination at that 25-year point where he would be eligible for parole. And, you know, because just because you're eligible for parole doesn't mean you're going to get out.
Yeah, and they make it more complicated because not only is he going to be eligible for parole, he's still probably going to have, like, cognitive problems. And they want him to come out, and he's going to be expected to pay for his own community parole. Like he's going to have to pay for his satellite-based monitoring. He's going to have to pay probation and parole fees. He's going to be expected to get a job. We're putting this kid and they do mark him up as a redeemable juvenile. I don't know where that comes from. It's on both sides' appellate arguments that they say that, you know, even in the case of a redeemable juvenile, this sentence is appropriate by the state. And the defense says this is not an appropriate sentence for a redeemable juvenile. So I don't know where that just means that they believe that like something could happen to make him a productive member of society. I don't know what that is. And I don't think that him spending, like you said, 20 to 40 years in prison before he's even released on parole makes any sense.
Well, he would just be eligible.
What I'm saying, if he gets right, he's suddenly eligible at, you know, 25 years. But if he gets released on parole, say he got some good time or like he did whatever it took. If he gets released on parole in 20 years or 30 years, he's not going to be a fine, upstanding citizen with a job that's able to comply with his, you know, his programming that's part of his parole and like to pay for his satellite based monitoring.
And I feel like that's where it comes in to play that his parole would be denied.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think that's a consideration that makes me wonder why, like how this is going to play out. Because, you waste all this time and all these resources trying to sort it in a way where it would just be more time and resources that are going to – like, I'm sure that's the reason that they're going to ultimately end up trying to figure out this kid's sentence. But I think he just would be denied parole as being resource heavy.
Well, right. He wouldn't because you have to meet so many qualifications to be granted it to begin with. Right. And, I don't know what the situation is going to be. My first inclination, which, you know, I doubt very seriously, is it's probably in La La Land because I feel like all children who commit crimes, violent crimes, right, they all should be treated. And what I mean by that is like, you know, having cognitive medical attention to figure out what on earth is going on with them and to try to help them, right? That doesn't happen, of course. But I do think the justice system can't be responsible for every aspect of every child, right? It's not responsible for it. All it does is bring justice when justice is required, right?
Yeah.
And so all these arguments fall on, you know, everything the justice system does has to not violate any part of the Constitution that guarantees us a right to something. All it is the law stating, the law being practiced by the state versus the defense. And, you know, what is a violation of, in this particular case, the right for all of the citizens of the United States to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. Court decisions have indicated that a child being sentenced to life in prison is, in effect, a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Yeah, you know, I could talk about these cases all day. And I hate that this is the segue that I'm dealing with, because I'm going to end up making this the most awkward segue we've ever had on the podcast. I brought this up as a case where, you know, we could see unfolding someone who had been victimized and ended up going to prison. But I also, and like I said, I'm also looking at a much older case right now that I drug you down the rabbit hole on. So this episode is going to turn into an interview portion. And so we're going to be talking to someone at the end of this episode. We're going to talk to them in the next episode as well. They come from the opposite perspective. They grew up having had a violent crime happen in their family that many, many, many years later continues to affect their family. In fact, over a course of 40 years, it's affecting them. So I'm going to move into the interview segment of this now. And this is going to, we'll come back and we'll talk about that a little bit at the beginning of the next episode after the interview segment plays out. So this is a little bit of a different take on what we do. We talk a lot about victims of crime and the family and friends from cases that you see in the mainstream media. But in this particular case, there's not just one victim. There's a lot of them, and it's become sort of a generational thing. So with me today, this is Katrina Marshall. And Katrina, why don't you tell me like where you are in life, kind of just like the general version of kind of what you do and like if there's kids, whatever you feel comfortable like telling an audience.
Sure. Yeah. I am now 31 years old. I have three kiddos, two daughters that are my oldest two, and my son, who's the youngest. They're all exactly 6 years apart somehow. It wasn't planned that way. So I've got a 15-year-old almost, a 9-year-old, and a 3-year-old to keep up with every day. I work in transportation. I'm pretty much the one that coordinates all the logistics and behind the scenes, you know, arrangements of, you know, cargo, transportation, trucking, logistics, shipping, receiving, supply chain management type stuff. My father was a trucker, so I guess it kind of ran in that side of the family. But I mean, my father is still alive. He's quite a bit older than my mom. They were married for 4 or 5 years before getting divorced. And I lost my mom on 11/11 of 2020. She took her own life in the state of Arizona, technically. It was in the middle of the pandemic. And I actually had COVID at that point, and so did all my kids. And so it was kind of blow after blow there that day.
I'm very sorry to hear that. That sounds very terrible.
It was pretty brutal. That was a day that I just was ready to end. I mean, that's the brief and short version of my life, I guess you could say. And then in my spare time, I pretty much try to keep digging on the case of my aunt and the fact that it's unsolved and trying to change that.
So where did you grow up geographically?
I grew up, well, since my parents were divorced growing up, I kind of split my time between Lawrence, Kansas and Wichita, Kansas. My dad is in Wichita. My mom was in Lawrence. And then when I was a teenager, she relocated to Arizona. And I spent 2 years with her there in Arizona before coming back to Kansas and staying with my dad to finish out high school.
Did you have a large extended family?
3 hours from each other. On my mom's side, yes. On my dad's side, no. I'm his only ever born child. I wasn't even born until he was in his like 40s or something. He has two siblings, but they never had kids. So I don't have any cousins or aunts or uncles really or anything on that side of the family.
You were close with your mom growing up. Is that accurate?
Close, definitely. We talked every day, multiple times a day, about, you know, everything from stupid to, you know, serious life stuff. I'm not going to say we got along very well a lot of the time. You know, girls and their moms butt heads, especially when they get in those teenage years, as I'm learning for myself as we speak. And so, I mean, we definitely had our fair share of arguments, for sure. However, she was, at the end, last 10 or 15 years of her life, legally and permanently mentally disabled. Like, officially, she was declared permanently disabled from her mental health for the last 10 or 15 years of her life. So she was like on disability and everything. But personally, I mean, me growing up with her and knowing her really well and how she is and how she was and why she was that way, for me, I was able to kind of, I guess, not immediately like write off her relationship like someone who might have met her more recently or something would, based on, you know, the way she acts or the things she might say because of her mental illness, I guess you could say.
As much as you're comfortable describing that, what would an interaction be like between the two of you that might stand out?
I mean, it kind of would depend on the day. You just never really knew what you were going to get. And I would say good words that accurately describe those interactions would be, she's very emotional, both good and bad. I mean, like, she'd cry at the drop of a hat over something good just as easily as she would if it were something bad. Impulsive, very impulsive, to the point of where if it was something, you know, that was bad, she didn't process it before she acted on it. Or reacted on it, I guess you could say. So basically, her emotions would take over her actions before she could actually, like, you know, think about it. And that's kind of where the impulsivity would come in. And, like, she would jump to conclusions a lot. That kind of thing. And then kind of just mentally check out if it was overwhelming enough. She just kind of had, she was very sensitive, very sensitive.
Were you guys similar?
A lot of people took advantage of that.
Okay.
No, I'm pretty opposite, to be honest with you. I don't know. I wasn't always that way, I guess, until I grew up watching my mom that way. And it pissed me off a lot because people would really take advantage of her genuine, like, niceness. You know, she's very, like, non-judgmental, accepting. She was really all about, you know, she loved the underdog stories kind of thing and bettering yourself growing, basically. And so I think some people, when they realize that about her, they would take advantage of it and kind of use her for whatever they could get out of her, whether it were actions or material things or, you know, whatever that may be. And it kind of, I guess, had that reverse effect and kind of made me opposite about it, because I would get angry for her since she wouldn't get angry about it herself. So I kind of became a little defensive and, I guess you could say, protective in that stance.
What age did you become protective of your mom?
Probably when I got old enough to understand the magnitude of what happened to her. To some extent, I still don't even think I fully understand it, but probably preteen years.
How many siblings did your mom have?
Oh boy, a lot. more than she even knew, actually, come to find out. There were five altogether. So the older two were boys. They were born first. They were all five stair-stepped. And so then were my mom and her sisters. They were, of course, also stair-stepped. So my oldest aunt, Katrina, the one I'm named after, came in 1961, and then Joanne in 1962, and then my mom in 1963. So they were like all five less than a year apart. So they were really close in age and also, you know, very close otherwise, especially the girls together. And so she had one older, the oldest boy was her half brother from a different father. And then she also had stepbrothers from my grandfather that my grandma married after my mom's real dad and her split up.
And that's Jim, Michael, and Mark, right?
Jim is the half brother, and then Michael and Mark all share the same mom and dad with my mom and her sisters. And then she's got some half siblings that I've just so recently found out about, actually, after doing DNA testing. That's kind of another story, but interesting as well, from my grandfather on my mom's side. But their biological father was never around growing up. And since my mom was the youngest, she always grew up with my step-grandfather as her father, basically.
So DNA testing, the ancestral DNA testing, what made you decide to do that?
Honestly, it was like, I think, a Mother's Day sale that I saw or something. I mean, it was always kind of interesting. I always kind of wondered. And, or no, I think it might have been like a St. Patrick's Day. It was, I don't know. They put it on sale all the time for just like random reasons. I don't know. But I ended up ordering one and it was pretty neat and very interesting. And then I also bought my father one when it went on sale for Father's Day. And so the next time he came to visit, I made him spit in the tube. And so it's pretty neat, actually. It's so complicated if you don't know anything about genealogy or anything, but it's still a mystery on my mom's side a little bit sometimes. So my grandfather had like married three or four different times and had families with all of them, and none of them knew about each other.
A lot of
step uncles and stuff.
That's what I was about to ask. But I was going to say my grandfather was married quite a few times, and I've often wondered. Meg is actually into DNA and genetics and genealogy. I am still I don't mind being connected to people, but I don't fully understand it.
I don't think anyone does, to be honest with you. It's so complicated, especially when you have, you know, 16 or 17,000 DNA matches. And those are just DNA matches that have tested on Ancestry or MyHeritage or whatever. Those don't even include the numbers of the people that haven't even done it.
So you started off talking about your mom, and you mentioned that your mom had killed herself. And you also mentioned in her taking her own life that she had a lot of siblings. You've been you're a very interesting person to read about in terms of all the connections you have to a lot of,
I want to call it interesting, but it's more strange and traumatic than interesting situations with your mom and her siblings. So her case, would you say that's the closest trauma or traumatic event as far as her and her siblings go for you personally?
Honestly, that's a really good question, actually. I'm not even really sure if I would consider that the most, I guess, traumatic in a sense. I mean, it was probably, I'm trying to figure out how to word this exactly. I would say I have my moments, obviously, but I guess I knew my mom and I knew her more better than anyone. We talked all the time, even when she lived in Arizona. And I know she was probably pretty difficult for some people to deal with, including myself sometimes. A little dramatic. But I mean, again, I sympathized with it. She made some unfavorable life decisions that didn't really help on that end either. But I guess we've all made those. That's how you learn. But she was miserable. She hated her existence overall. And I honestly felt like she was just, you know, miserably going through life each and every day just for me.
That's a lot of pressure.
I think that in the end, like, in a way, as bad as it sounds to say, like, obviously it's not something I would have chosen. However, you know, if it finally kind of like freed her from the hell that she felt like she was living in every single day and truly, you know, wanted to be free from it, then I guess what other choice do I have but to support that decision? I guess I'm just glad I got the closure that I did get. A lot of people in that situation, you know, are usually, or at least they claim they had no idea, or wow, I didn't see that coming, or, you know, that kind of a reaction. But I knew it was coming. I knew it was going to happen eventually. She'd had several attempts before, unsuccessfully, of course. I just wanted her to be not miserable anymore, honestly.
How has her choosing that way out, how has it affected you in these last 2 years?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I'm kind of glad my mom didn't have to be alive and see or hear or be informed of some of the stuff that I have found out since she's passed away, especially in regards to her sister's cases, because, man, it's pretty unfathomable and almost dumbfounding in some ways. Some of the stuff that has been hidden and secretive for so long about these things that she'd probably roll over in her grave after hearing them. I'm just being honest, but it's hard, I guess. I have my moments where if I hear a song or I'm reminded of something or, you know. But I've also got 3 kids that keep me pretty, I guess, distracted on those days, especially that are hard. And it kind of just, I guess I think I fueled it into this case. The anger or sadness has kind of been redirected into figuring out what happened. Not necessarily to find answers. I mean, of course, that would be nice, but more to find closure in general, whether it's for my mom or my aunts or even just the effort of trying, I feel like, is better than nothing.
How has it affected your kids?
Well, my oldest is probably the only one that was has a lot of memories, you know, of her overall. And the memories she has of her aren't necessarily good ones, I wouldn't say. They were, you know, towards the end of her life, so she wasn't really very grandmotherly. and her actions and words, unfortunately. I really wish my kids could have seen the mom that I remember, of course, before, you know, things went downhill so much, but she didn't ever used to be that way.
I was going to, that's sort of leads into my question, and that was going to be with your mom. So obviously because of your AIDS, you were born sort of after one major trauma in your mom's life, but right before another.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. So my mom and dad met each other and they got married 2 years before I was born. And they were married for like 5 years. And so in 1991, January, so the beginning of 91, I was born, which my oldest aunt, the one I'm named after, of course, was killed in 85. And so then my mom, of course, was, you know, devastated. But eventually she met my dad and they ended up getting married. And then I came along 2 years later. And then 2 years after I was born, and I think during that point in my mom's life, it kind of revived her a little bit and gave her, you know, that glimmer, I think, of hope again, and also kind of gave her a chance to memorialize her sister by, you know, passing down her name to me as well. So it kind of, I think, gave her that desire to live again, you know what I mean? And then, of course, 2 years after I was born, in 93, my other aunt was murdered also. And then there was no coming back from that. She went steadily and consistently downhill after that until the very end.
Well, I've been talking to you for a while now, and you seem very well put together to find yourself as a mom and working full time and also having this sideline where you're not only promoting the story and attempting to get attention to it, meaning the story of one of your aunts, and we're going to get to both of them. But you're also in a position where you've literally found yourself as an investigator pushing to get all of the facts of this story. How did you find yourself in the position of being the one to be doing all of this investigative work?
Honestly, it was when my mom was still alive, actually. Once I got to, you know, adulthood, my mother and I kind of teamed up together to start working on it and figure it out, you know, especially during the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was stuck at home. And I started getting more curious and wondering, I mean, I am named after the person after all, you know? And so my mom would always just say, yeah, I checked in with Dallas today and no updates or anything. I'm like, that's literally like every single time you check in. Like my entire life, literally. Like, are you sure that's what they said? Like, they didn't say anything else ever, never. And she's like, no, they're, you know, they're still investigating and trying to figure it out. And eventually I was just kind of like, I just kind of felt like I got that feeling like maybe they were giving her the runaround a little bit or something. Just didn't quite sit right with me, I think. I'm pretty good at, I think, getting those vibes or intuition and kind of reading between the lines, I guess you could say. And so my curiosity, of course, got the best of me, and I went ahead and I ordered the death certificate. I was curious what they had listed as the cause of death and just kind of wanted some clarification because I knew that my mom's story was probably understandably a little biased.
So you felt like you needed to dig into it, and I'm paraphrasing. You're digging into it from one angle to sort of clarify her take on things. Is that like Is that part of the idea?
I wanted some documentation in black and white to back up the department's claims of their ongoing investigation. I wanted some type of, you know, proof or anything. I'm kind of surprised my mom didn't already have that stuff, to be honest. But
and I'm sure did you get the proof that you were looking for? And what did that reveal to you?
Well, it wasn't really the proof I was looking for or expected, but it was the proof that needed to be, you know, communicated.
Did it leave you with the impression that there was an active ongoing investigation?
No, not at all. It was it was pretty shocking, and I knew as soon as I got it, because it came to my house in the mail eventually, and I knew as soon as I got it and saw it, I knew exactly how my mom was going to react, and I knew it wasn't going to be good, and I really had no other choice or option because she knew I had ordered it, and she knew it was coming, and so I had to tell her, you know, and send her a copy of it for what it said. And it said that her cause of death was undetermined following the complete investigation, toxicology, and autopsy.
And how long had passed since your aunt had died? How long was it between the time you got it in the mail and she had passed away?
Like 30 or 40 years.
So a really long time.
Yeah. And so eventually I'm like, okay, so what exactly does this mean? And it means exactly what I figured it probably meant, that it wasn't, you know, actively investigated like they had always led us to believe it was. It was pretty false.
Do you have any idea why your mom was getting those types of answers? Like, in your opinion, why was somebody telling her that they were working on it when that was clearly not the case?
I think they were just kind of, I don't know if it's laziness or didn't really feel like doing the digging that it would have taken because, you know, it is an older case now at this point. You know, I mean, I've heard a lot of excuses myself at this point too. And I mean, I just felt like they were kind of just keeping her, you know, in a cycle or going in a circle of repetitive excuses of some kind, if anyone just sort of even knew what they were talking about. Yeah,
just placating the situation so she to get off the phone with
prolonging her. Prolonging it and dragging it out more and more, hoping she would just eventually say screw it and give up and I guess not call anymore or something.
John and I go through sort of cycles with cases that we cover where we talk about how law enforcement, there's sort of two sides to things where you can have incompetence and you can have malfeasance, right? So you've got basically law enforcement that they're not necessarily trying to do anything wrong. They just don't have the skills to accomplish what they need to be accomplishing. And then, you know, with malfeasance, you've got like somebody deliberately setting out to, you know, not do the right thing. Do you have an opinion?
I think it's some of both.
Okay.
Both, equally both for sure. And I'm not saying like, you know, everyone now is that way, but it could have been, you know, people from the past as well that have gone and retired and died even or been fired, hired, you know. I mean, no one there at this point has firsthand experience with this specific case, you know, in this time period anyway. And so they don't really have that experience or closeness, or they don't feel a connection to the case because they didn't really know anything about it to begin with. And so I mean I've the communications I've had with them were pretty ridiculous. I mean, it took one detective, a lieutenant in the homicide unit specifically, 6 months to figure out how to utilize their own database to look up the last name correctly.
Oh no.
That kind of thing is just unacceptable to me. And the fact that a huge city like Dallas has a homicide lieutenant in their department that doesn't know any better than that is really alarming.
Right. And that leans more towards incompetence, I think, because, and, you know, as we started doing investigations, I was, I'm less startled now, but at first I was very startled at sort of where my expectations were and where sort of the bar of how they had to act fell. It was way lower than what I expected in most cases, right? And when I read, I think I read your petition and I've read like a few articles, I think maybe that have stemmed from the petition. I was immediately outraged at how old the case is. And I immediately, I try to go towards incompetence as opposed to malfeasance because that makes me less mad at law enforcement, you know, because if they're just incompetent to do it, it doesn't seem like they're at least, they're not intentionally like disregarding someone, right? And
very true.
And I was outraged though that you being the niece of the victim in this case are now picking up the pieces of this, you know, 40 years later. I'm not actually, it was in 1985, so a little less than 40 years later. And I think to myself as, you know, as an investigator, like, why on earth is this situation happening? Why are you having to go through this? Except we already kind of know because John and I have seen this happen over and over again. And it's almost as if your aunt's case just fell right through the cracks and you're left to try and pick up any pieces you can find and like put it back together and beg them to help you.
Well, and, you know, and that's the thing. I pretty much, you know, I have a lot of the pieces that they don't, and it might go vice versa, but I can't do it or put pieces together that I don't have the rest of. And they're not, you know, communicative or responsive. And when they do answer, they're not helpful at all. They just direct you to someone else who sends you elsewhere, who sends you elsewhere. But then they also state that they're not, it's, this case is not in their homicide database because it's not a homicide. It's undetermined, which I'm pretty sure all homicides are undetermined until they're figured out anyway.
Right. We've talked a lot about with the manners of death and, you know, you're right, undetermined or accidental, they don't necessarily warrant an investigation, right, by law enforcement.
But this technically was announced in the media, in the news, specifically quoted by the Dallas police multiple times that this was a cocaine overdose. And that they found her and that she had died of a cocaine overdose. And they had called my grandmother and told her that her daughter died of a cocaine overdose. And that is the only phone call that she ever got. They never called her to clarify.
Any of the information that you've gotten from law enforement, has it indicated how it went from the cocaine overdose to her being naked and wrapped in a bed sheet in the trunk of a car?
No, they never said anything or gave any explanation or clarification. I ordered the full autopsy and toxicology reports, and that's how I found out. I never found out anything from law enforcement. I've had to find it out around them somehow every time.
You know, just my sort of thinking, not necessarily your aunt, but anybody in this type of situation, I would think to myself, well, okay, if someone overdoses, they don't wrap themselves in a bed sheet and end up in a trunk, which I think is sort of where this all starts falling apart, right? And to
it wasn't a cocaine overdose. There was no cocaine in her system.
Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabbrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabbrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5000. 5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com. And you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.
This is True Crime XS.